Chapter 13. At the beginning of that year, Thomas and Fermin decided to pool their respective brains on a new project that they predicted would get us both out of being drafted. Fermin, in particular, did not share Mr. Aguiar's enthusiasm for the army experience. "The only useful thing about military service is that it reveals the number of morons in the population," he would remark, "and that can be discovered in the first 2 weeks. There's no need for 2 years. Army, marriage, the church and banking. The four horsemen of the apocalypse. Yes, go on, laugh." Fermín Romero de Torres's anarchist libertarian leanings were to be shaken one October afternoon when, in a twist of fate, we had a visit from an old friend. My father had gone to Argentona to price a book collection and would not be back until the evening. I was left in charge of the counter, while Fermín insisted on climbing up a ladder like a tightrope walker to tidy up the books on the top shelf, just inches from the ceiling. Shortly before closing time, when the sun had already set, Bernarda's profile appeared at the shop window. She was dressed in her Thursday clothes. Thursday was her day off, and she waved at me. My heart soared just to see her, and I signalled to her to come in. "My goodness, how you've grown," she said from the entrance. "I would hardly have recognised you. Why, you're a man now." She embraced me, shedding a few tears and touching my head, shoulders and face, as if to make sure I hadn't broken anything during her absence. "You're really missed in the house, Master Daniel," she said, with downcast eyes. "I've missed you too, Bernarda. Come on, give me a kiss." She kissed me shyly, and I planted a couple of noisy kisses on each cheek. She laughed. In her eyes, I could see she was waiting for me to ask her about Clara, but I had decided not to. "You're looking very pretty today and very elegant. How come you've decided to pay us a visit?" "The truth is, I've been wanting to come for a long time, but you know how things are. We're all busy, and for all his learning, Signor Barceló is as demanding as a child. You just have to rise above it and get on with things. But what brings me here today is that... Well, tomorrow is my niece's birthday, the one from San Adrián, and I'd like to give her a present. I thought I could get her a good book with a lot of writing and few pictures, but as I'm such a dimwit and don't understand..." Before I could answer, a whole hardback set of the complete works of Blasco Ibáñez plummeted from on high and the place shook with a ballistic roar. Bernarda and I looked up anxiously. Fermín was sliding down the ladder like a trapeze artist, a secretive smile lighting up his face, his eyes filled with rapturous lust. "Bernarda, this is Fermín Romero de Torres, bibliographic advisor to Sempere and Son at your service, madame," Fermín proclaimed, taking Bernarda's hand and kissing it ceremoniously. "You must be confused. I'm no madame." "Marquise, at the very least," interrupted Fermín. "I should know. I have stepped out with the finest ladies on Avenida Pearson. Allow me the honour of accompanying you to our classic section for children and young adults, where I notice that by good fortune we have an anthology of the best of Emilio Salgari and his epic tale of Sandokan." "Oh dear, I don't know. I'm not sure about the lives of the saints. The girl's father used to be very left-wing, you know." "Say no more, for here I have none other than Jules Verne's The Mysterious Island, a tale of high adventure and great educational content, because of all the science."
"If you think so."
I followed them quietly, noticing how Fermín was drooling over Bernarda, and how she seemed overwhelmed by the attentions showered upon her by the little man with scruffy looks and the tongue of a stallholder. He was devouring her with his eyes as greedily as if she were a piece of chocolate.
"Oh, what about you, Master Daniel? What do you think?"
"Fermín Romero de Torres is the resident expert here. You can trust him."
"Well, then, I'll take the one about the island, if you'd be kind enough to wrap it for me. What do I owe you?"
"It's on the house," I said.
"No, it isn't. I won't hear of it."
"If you allow me, madame, it's on me. Fermín Romero de Torres, you'd make me the happiest man in Barcelona." Bernarda looked at us both. She was speechless.
"Listen, I'm paying for what I buy, and this is a present I want to give my niece." Well, then perhaps you'll allow me in exchange to invite you to afternoon tea. Fan Min quickly interjected, smoothing down his hair. Go on, Bernarda, I encouraged her. You'll enjoy yourself. Look, while I wrap this up, Fan Min can go and get his jacket. Fan Min hurried off to the back room to comb his hair, splash on some cologne and put on his jacket. I slipped him a few duros from the till. Where shall I take her? He whispered to me, as nervous as a child. I'd take her to Els Quatre Gats, I said. I know for a fact that it's a lucky place for romance. I handed Bernarda the packet and winked at her. What do I owe you then, Master Daniel? I'm not sure. I'll let you know. The book didn't have a price on it, and I have to ask my father. I lied. I watched them leave arm in arm and disappear down Calle Santana, hoping there was somebody on duty up in heaven who, for once, would grant the couple a lucky break. I hung the closed notice in the shop window. I had just gone into the back room for a moment to look through my father's order book when I heard the tinkle of the doorbell. I thought Fermin must have forgotten something, or perhaps my father was back from his day trip. Hello? A few seconds passed, and no answer came. I continued to leaf through the order book. I heard slow footsteps in the shop.
Fermin? Father?
No answer. I thought I heard a stifled laugh, and I shut the order book. Perhaps some client had ignored the closed sign. I was about to go and serve whoever it was when I heard the sound of several books falling from the shelves. I swallowed. Grabbing hold of a letter opener, I slowly moved towards the door of the back room. I didn't dare call out a second time. Soon I heard the steps again, walking away. The doorbell sounded, and I felt a draught of air from the street. I peered into the shop. There was no one there. I ran to the front door and double-locked it, then took a deep breath, feeling ridiculous and cowardly. I was returning to the back room when I noticed a piece of paper on the counter. As I got closer, I realized it was a photograph, an old studio picture of the sort that were printed on thick cardboard. The edges were burned, and the smoky image seemed to have charcoal finger marks over it. I examined it under the lamp. The photograph showed a young couple smiling at the camera. The man didn't look much older than 17 or 18, with light-coloured hair and delicate aristocratic features. The woman may have been a bit younger, 1 or 2 years at the most. She had pale skin and a finely chiselled face framed by short black hair. She looked drunk with happiness. The man had his arm round her waist, and she seemed to be whispering something to him in a teasing way. The image conveyed a warmth that drew a smile from me, as if I had recognised two old friends in those strangers. Behind them, I could make out an ornate shop window full of old-fashioned hats. I concentrated on the couple. From their clothes, I could guess that the picture was at least 25 or 30 years old. It was an image full of light and hope, rich with promise that only exists in the eyes of the young. Fire had destroyed almost all of the area surrounding the photograph, but you could still discern a stern face behind the old-style counter, a suggestion of a ghostly figure behind the letters engraved on the glass. Sons of Antonio Fortuny, established in 1888. The night I returned to the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, Isaac had told me that Carax used his mother's surname, not his father's, which was Fortuny. Carax's father had a hat shop in Ronda de San Antonio. I looked again at the portrait of that couple and knew for sure that the young man was Julian Carax, smiling at me from the past, unable to see the flames that were closing in on him. City of Shadows, 1954. Chapter 14. The following morning, Fermín came to work borne on the wings of Cupid, smiling and whistling boleros. In any other circumstances, I would have inquired about his outing with Bernarda, but that day I was not in the mood for his poetic outbursts. My father had arranged to have an order of books delivered to Professor Javier Velázquez at 11 o'clock in his study at the university. The very mention of a professor made Fermín wince, so I offered to take the books myself. "That sorry specimen is nothing but a corrupt pedant, a fascist buttock polisher," Fermín declared, raising his fist and striking the pose he reserved for his avenging moods. "He uses the pitiful excuse of his professorship to seduce women. I swear he would even have it off with Gertrude Stein, given the chance." "Calm down, Fermín. Velázquez pays well, always in advance, and besides, he recommends us to everyone," my father said. "That's money stained with the blood of innocent virgins," Fermín protested. "For the life of God, I hereby swear that I have never lain with an underage woman, and not for lack of inclination or opportunities. Bear in mind that what you see today is but a shadow of my former self, but there was a time when I cut as dashing a figure as they come. Yet even then, just to be on the safe side, or if I sensed that a girl might be overly flighty, I would not proceed without seeing some form of identification, or failing that, a written paternal authorization. One has to maintain certain moral standards." My father rolled his eyes. "It's pointless arguing with you, Fermín." "Well, if I'm right, I'm right." Sensing a debate brewing, I picked up the parcel, which I had prepared the night before, a couple of Rilke's and an apocryphal essay attributed to a disciple of Darwin claiming that Spaniards came from a more evolved simian ancestor than their French neighbours. As the door closed behind me, Fermín and my father were deep in argument about ethics. It was a magnificent day. The skies were electric blue, and a crystal breeze carried the cool scent of autumn and the sea. I always prefer Barcelona in October. It is when the spirit of the city seems to stroll most proudly through the streets, and you feel all the wiser after drinking water from the old fountain of Canaletas, which for once does not taste of chlorine. I was walking along briskly, dodging bootblacks, pen pushers, returning from their mid-morning coffee, lottery vendors, and a whole ballet of street sweepers who seemed intent on polishing the streets, using their brooms like paintbrushes, unhurriedly, and with a pointillist's strokes. Barcelona was already beginning to fill up with cars in those days, and when I reached the traffic light at the crossing with Calle Balmes, I noticed a brigade of grey office clerks in grey raincoats staring hungrily at a blood-red Studebaker sedan, as they would ogle a music hall siren in a negligee. I went on up Balmes towards Gran Vía, negotiating traffic lights, cars and even motorcycles with sidecars. In a shop window, I saw a Philips poster announcing the arrival of a new Messiah, the TV set. Some predicted that this peculiar contraption was going to change our lives forever and turn us all into creatures of the future, like the Americans. Fermín Romero de Torres, always up to date on state-of-the-art technology, had already prophesied a grimmer outcome. "Television, my dear Daniel, is the Antichrist, and I can assure you that after only 3 or 4 generations, people will no longer even know how to fart on their own. Humans will return to living in caves, to medieval savagery, and to the general state of imbecility that slugs overcame back in the Pleistocene era. Our world will not die as a result of the bomb, as the papers say. It will die of laughter, of banality, of making a joke of everything, and a lousy joke at that." Professor Velázquez's office was on the 2nd floor of the literature faculty in Plaza Universidad, at the end of a gallery paved with hypnotic chessboard tiling and awash in powdery light that spilled down onto the southern cloister. I found the professor at the door of a lecture room, pretending to be listening to a female student while considering her spectacular figure. She wore a dark red suit that drew attention to her waistline and revealed classically proportioned calves covered in fine silk stockings. Professor Velázquez enjoyed a reputation as a Don Juan. There were those who considered that the sentimental education of a respectable young lady was never complete without a proverbial weekend in some small hotel on the Sitka's promenade, reciting Alexandrian's tête-à-tête with a distinguished academic. My commercial instincts advise me against interrupting his conversation, so I decided to kill time by undressing the pupil in my mind. Perhaps the brisk walk had raised my spirits, or perhaps it was just my age, not to mention the fact that I spent more time among muses that were trapped in the pages of old books than in the company of girls of flesh and bone, who always seemed to me beings of a far lower order than Clara Barceló. Whatever the reason, as I catalogued each and every detail of her enticing and exquisitely clad anatomy, which I could see only from the back, but which in my mind I had already visualised in its full glory, I felt a vaguely wolfish shiver run down my spine.
"Why, here's Daniel!" cried Professor Belasquez. "Thank goodness it's you, not that madman who came last time, the one with a name like a bullfighter! He seemed drunk to me, or certifiable. He had the nerve to ask me whether I knew the etymology of the word prick, in a sarcastic tone that was quite out of place.
It's just that the doctor has put him on some strong medication, something to do with his liver."
"No doubt because he's smashed all day," said Belasquez. "If I were you, I'd call the police. I bet you he has a file, and God, how his feet stank. There are lots of shitty leftists on the loose who haven't seen a bathtub since the Republic fell."
I was about to come up with some other plausible excuse for Fermín, when the student who had been talking to Professor Belasquez turned around, and it was as if the world had stopped spinning. I saw her smile at me, and my ears went up in flames.
"Hello, Daniel," said Beatriz Aguilar.
I nodded at her, tongue-tied. I realised I'd been drooling over my best friend's sister, Bea, the one woman I was completely terrified of.
"Oh, so you know each other?" asked Belasquez, intrigued.
"Daniel is an old friend of the family," Bea explained, "and the only one who ever had the courage to tell me to my face that I'm stuck up and vain."
Belasquez looked at me with astonishment.
"That was years ago," I explained, "and I didn't mean it." "Well, I'm still waiting for an apology."
Belasquez laughed heartily and took the parcel from my hands.
"I think I'm in the way here," he said, opening it.
"Ah, wonderful. Listen, Daniel, tell your father I'm looking for a book called Moorslayer, Early Reminiscences of the Generalissimo in the Moroccan War by Francisco Franco Bahamonde, with a prologue and notes by Perman.
Consider it done. We'll let you know in a couple of weeks."
"I'll take your word for it, and now I'll be off. 32 blank minds await me."
Professor Belasquez winked at me and disappeared into the lecture room. I didn't know where to look.
"Listen, Bea, about that insult, I promise I..."
"I was only teasing you, Daniel. I know that was childish nonsense, and besides, Tomás gave you a good enough beating."
"It still hurts." Bea's smile looked like a peace offering, or at least an offer of a truce.
"Besides, you were right. I'm a bit stuck up and sometimes a little vain," she said. "You don't like me much, do you, Daniel?"
The question took me completely by surprise. Disarmed, I realised how easily you can lose all animosity towards someone you've deemed your enemy as soon as that person stops behaving as such.
"No, that's not true. Tomás says it's not that you don't like me, it's that you can't stand my father, and you make me pay for it, because you don't dare face up to him. I don't blame you. No one dares cross my father."
I felt the blood drain from my cheeks. But after a few seconds, I found myself smiling and nodding. Anyone would say Tomás knows me better than I know myself.
"I wouldn't put it past him. My brother knows us all inside out. Only he never says anything. But if he ever decides to open his mouth, the whole world will collapse. He's very fond of you, you know."
I raised my shoulders and looked down.
"He's always talking about you, and about your father, and the bookshop, and this friend you have working with you. Tomás says he's a genius waiting to be discovered. Sometimes it's as if he considers you his real family, instead of the one he has at home."
My eyes met hers, hard, frank, fearless. I did not know what to say, so I just smiled. I felt she was ensnaring me with her honesty, and I looked down at the courtyard.
I didn't know you studied here.
It's my first year.
Literature?
My father thinks science is not for the weaker sex.
Of course, too many numbers.
I don't care, because what I like is reading. Besides, you meet interesting people here.
Like Professor Belathquith. Bea gave me a wry smile.
I might be in my first year, but I know enough to see them coming, Daniel. Especially men of his sort.
I wondered what sort I was.
Besides, Professor Belathquith is a good friend of my father's. They both belong to the Society for the Protection and Promotion of Spanish Operetta.
I tried to look impressed.
A noble calling. And how's your boyfriend, Lieutenant Cascos Buendía?
Her smile left her.
Pablo will be here on leave in 3 weeks.
You must be happy.
Very. He's a great guy, though I can imagine what you must think of him.
I doubt it, I thought.
Bea watched me, looking slightly tense. I was about to change the subject, but my tongue got ahead of me. Tomás says you're getting married and you're going off to live in El Ferrol.
She nodded without blinking.
As soon as Pablo finishes his military service?
You must be feeling impatient, I said, sensing a spiteful note in my voice, an insolent tone that came from God knows where.
I don't mind, really. His family has property out there, a couple of shipyards, and Pablo is going to be in charge of one of them. He has a great talent for leadership.
It shows.
Bea forced a smile. Besides, I've seen quite enough of Barcelona after all these years.
Her eyes looked tired and sad.
I hear El Ferrol is a fascinating place, full of life, and the seafood is supposed to be fabulous, especially the spider crabs.
Bea sighed, shaking her head. She looked as if she wanted to cry with anger but was too proud. Instead, she laughed calmly.
After 10 years, you still enjoy insulting me, don't you, Daniel? Go on then, don't hold back. It's my fault for thinking that perhaps we could be friends, or pretend to be, but I suppose I'm not as good as my brother. I'm sorry I've wasted your time.
She turned around and started walking down the corridor that led to the library.
I saw her move away along the black and white tiles, her shadow cutting through the curtains of light that fell from the gallery windows. Bea, wait!
I cursed myself and ran after her.
I stopped her halfway down the corridor, grabbing her by the arm.
She threw me a burning look.
I'm sorry, but you're wrong. It's not your fault, it's mine. I'm the one who isn't as good as your brother, and if I've insulted you, it's because I'm jealous of that idiot boyfriend of yours. And because I'm angry to think that someone like you would follow him to El Ferrol. It might as well be the Congo. Daniel, you're wrong about me because we can be friends if you let me try, now that you know how worthless I am. And you're wrong about Barcelona too, because you may think you've seen everything, but I can guarantee that's not true. If you'll allow me, I can prove it to you.
I saw a smile light up, and a slow, silent tear fall down her cheek.
You'd better be right, she said. Because if you're not, I'll tell my brother, and he'll pull your head off like a stopper.
I held out my hand to her.
That sounds fair. Friends?
She offered me hers.
What time do your classes finish on Friday?
I asked.
She hesitated for a moment. At 5? I'll be waiting for you in the cloister at 5 o'clock sharp. Before dark, I'll prove to you that there's something in Barcelona you haven't seen yet, and that you can't go off to El Ferrol with that idiot. I don't believe you love him. If you go, the memory of this city will pursue you, and you'll die of sadness. You seem very sure of yourself, Daniel.
I, who was never even sure what the time was, nodded with a conviction of the ignorant. I stood there watching her walk away down that endless corridor until her silhouette blended with the darkness. I asked myself what on earth I had done. Chapter 15. The Fortuny Hat Shop, or what was left of it, languished at the foot of a narrow, miserable-looking building, blackened by soot
in Ronda de San Antonio, next to Plaza de Goya. You could still read the letters engraved on the filthy window, and a sign in the shape of a bowler hat still hung above the shop front, promising designs made to measure and the latest novelties from Paris. The door was secured with a padlock that had seen at least a decade of undisturbed service. I pressed my forehead against the glass, trying to peek into the murky interior.
"If you've come about the rental, you're late," spat a voice behind my back. "The manager has already left."
The woman who was speaking to me must have been about 60 and wore the national costume of all pious widows. A couple of rollers stuck out under the pink scarf that covered her hair, and her padded slippers matched her flesh-coloured knee-high stockings. I assumed she was the caretaker of the building.
"Is the shop for rent?"
"Isn't that why you've come?"
"Not really, but you never know. I might be interested." The caretaker frowned, debating whether to grant me the benefit of the doubt. I slipped on my trademark angelic smile.
"How long has the shop been closed?"
"For a good 12 years, since the old man died."
"Signor Fortuny, did you know him?"
"I've been here for 48 years, young man."
"So perhaps you also knew Signor Fortuny's son?"
"Julian? Well, of course."
I took the burned photograph out of my pocket and showed it to her. "Do you think you'd be able to tell me whether the young man in the photograph is Julian Carax?" The caretaker looked at me rather suspiciously. She took the photograph and stared at it.
"Do you recognise him?"
"Carax was his mother's maiden name," the caretaker explained in a disapproving tone. "This is Julian, yes. I remember him being very fair, but here in the photograph his hair looks darker."
"Could you tell me who the girl is?"
"And who is asking?"
"Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Daniel Sempere. I'm trying to find out about Signor Carax, about Julian."
"Julian went to Paris around about 1918 or 1919. His father wanted to shove him in the army, you see. I think the mother took him with her so that he could escape from all that, poor kid. Signor Fortuny was left alone in the attic apartment."
"Do you know when Julian returned to Barcelona?"
The caretaker looked at me, but didn't speak for a while.
"Don't you know? Julian died that same year in Paris."
"Excuse me?"
"I said Julian passed away in Paris soon after he got there. He would have done better joining the army."
"May I ask you how you know that?"
"How do you think? Because his father told me."
I nodded slowly.
"I see. Did he say what he died of?"
"Quite frankly, the old man never gave me any details. Once, not long after Julian left, a letter arrived for him, and when I mentioned it to his father, he told me his son had died, and if anything else came for him, I should throw it away." "Why are you looking at me like that?"
"Signor Fortuny lied to you. Julian didn't die in 1919.
"Say that again?"
"Julian lived in Paris until at least 1935, and then he returned to Barcelona."
The caretaker's face lit up.
"So Julian is here, in Barcelona. Where?"
I nodded again, hoping she would be encouraged to tell me more.
"Holy Mary, what wonderful news! Well, if he's still alive, that is. He was such a sweet child. A bit strange, and given to daydreaming, that's true, but there was something about him that won you over. He wouldn't have been much good as a soldier. You could tell that a mile off. My Isabelita really liked him. Imagine, for a while I even thought they'd end up getting married. Oh, kid stuff. May I see that photograph again?"
I handed the photo back to her. The caretaker gazed at it, as if it were a lucky charm, a return ticket to her youth.
"It's strange, you know. It's as if he were here right now. And that mean old bastard saying he was dead. I must say, I wonder why God sends some people into this world. And what happened to Julian in Paris? I'm sure he got rich. I always thought Julian would be wealthy one day."
"Not exactly. He became a writer."
He wrote stories?
Something like that.
For the radio! Oh, how lovely! Well, it doesn't surprise me, you know. As a child, he used to tell stories to the local kids. In the summer, sometimes, my Isabelita and her cousins would go up to the roof terrace at night and listen to him. They said he never told the same story twice, but it's true that they were all about dead people and ghosts. As I say, he was a bit of an odd child, although with a father like that, the odd thing was that he wasn't completely nuts. I'm not surprised that his wife left him in the end because he was a nasty piece of work. Listen, I never meddle in people's affairs. Everything's fine by me, but that man wasn't a good person. In a block of apartments, nothing secret in the end. He beat her, you know. You always heard screams coming from their apartment, and more than once the police had to come round. I can understand that sometimes a husband has to beat his wife to get her to respect him. I'm not saying they shouldn't. There's a lot of tarts about, and young girls are not brought up the way they used to be. But this one, well, he liked to beat her for the hell of it, if you see what I mean. The only friend that poor woman had was a young girl, Vicentetta, who lived in 4-2. Sometimes the poor woman would take shelter in Vicentetta's apartment to get away from her husband's beatings. And she told her things.
What sort of things? The caretaker took on a confidential manner, raising an eyebrow and glancing sideways right and left.
Like the boy wasn't the Hatter's.
Julian? You mean to say Julian wasn't Fortuny's son?
That's what the French woman told Vicentetta. I don't know whether it was out of spite or heaven knows why. The girl told me years later when they didn't live here anymore.
So who was Julian's real father?
The French woman never said. Perhaps she didn't even know. You know what foreigners are like.
And do you think that's why her husband beat her?
Goodness knows! 3 times they had to take her to hospital. 3 times the swine had the nerve to tell everyone that she was the one to blame. That she was a drunk and was always falling about the house from drinking too much. But I don't believe that. He quarrelled with all the neighbours. Once even went to the police to report my late husband, God rest his soul, for stealing from his shop. As far as he was concerned, anyone from the south was a layabout and a thief. The pig.
Did you say you recognised the girl who is next to Julian in the photograph? The caretaker concentrated on the image once again.
Never seen her before. Very pretty.
From the picture, it looks like they were a couple, I suggested, trying to jog her memory. She handed it back to me, shaking her head.
I don't know anything about photographs. As far as I know, Julian never had a girlfriend. But I imagine that if he did, he wouldn't have told me. It was hard enough finding out that my Isabelita had got involved with that fellow. You young people never say anything, and us old folks don't know how to stop talking.
Do you remember his friends? Anyone special who came round here? The caretaker shrugged her shoulders.
Well, it was such a long time ago. Besides, in the last years, Julian was hardly ever here, you see. He'd made a friend at school. A boy from a very good family. The Aldayas. Now, that's saying something. Oh, nobody talks about them now, but in those days, it was like mentioning the royal family. Lots of money. I know because sometimes they would send a car to fetch Julian. You should have seen that car. Not even Franco would have one like it, with a chauffeur and all shiny. My Paco, who knew about cars, told me that it was a Rolls-Royce or something like that, fit for an emperor.
Do you remember the friend's first name?
Listen, with a surname like Aldaya, there's no need for first names. I also remember another boy, a bit of a scatterbrain called Miquel. I think he was also a classmate. But don't ask me for his surname or what he looked like.
We seemed to have reached a dead end, and I feared that the caretaker would start losing interest. I decided to follow a hunch. Is anyone living in the Fortuny apartment now?
No. The old man died without leaving a will, and his wife, as far as I know, is still in Buenos Aires, and didn't even come back for the funeral. Can't blame her.
Why Buenos Aires?
Because she couldn't find anywhere further away, I guess. She left everything in the hands of a lawyer, a very strange man. I've never seen him, But my daughter, Isabelita, who lives on the fifth floor, right underneath, says that sometimes since he has the key, he comes at night and spends hours walking around the apartment and then leaves. Once she said that she could even hear what sounded like women's high heels. What can I say?
Maybe they were stilts, I suggested. She looked at me blankly. Obviously, this was a serious subject for the caretaker. And nobody else has visited the apartment in all these years.
Once this very creepy individual came along, one of those people who never stopped smiling, a giggler, but you could see him coming a mile off. He said he was in the crime squad. He wanted to see the apartment.
Did he say why? The caretaker shook her head. Do you remember his name?
Inspector something or other. I didn't even believe he was a policeman. The whole thing stank. Do you know what I mean? It smelled of something personal. I sent him packing and told him I didn't have the keys to the apartment and if he wanted anything, he should call the lawyer. He said he'd come back. But I haven't seen him round here again. Good riddance.
You wouldn't by any chance have the name and address of the lawyer, would you?
You should ask the manager of this building, Signor Mullins. His office is quite close, number 28, Florida Banca, first floor. Tell him I sent you, Signora Aurora, at your service.
I'm very grateful. So tell me, Doña Aurora, is the Fortuny apartment empty then?
No, not empty, because nobody has taken anything from it in all the years since the old man died. Sometimes it even smells. I'd say there are rats in the apartment, mark my words.
Do you think it would be possible to have a look? We might find something that tells us what really happened to Julian.
Oh no, I couldn't do that. You must talk to Signor Mullins. He's the one in charge.
I smiled at her mischievously. But you must have a master key, I imagine. Even if you told that man you didn't. Don't tell me you're not dying to see what's in there. Doña Aurora looked at me out of the corner of her eye.
You're a devil.
The door gave way like a tombstone with a sudden groan, exhaling dank, foul-smelling air. I pushed the front door inwards, discovering a corridor that sank into darkness. The place was stuffy and reeked of damp. Spiralling threads of grime and dust hung from the ceiling like white hair. The broken floor tiles were covered by what looked like a layer of ash. I also noticed what appeared to be footprints making their way into the apartment.
"Holy Mother of God!" mumbled the caretaker. "There's more shit here than on the floor of a hen house!"
"If you'd rather, I'll go in on my own," I said.
That's exactly what you'd like. Come on, you go ahead, I'll follow.
We closed the door behind us and waited by the entrance for a moment until our eyes became accustomed to the dark. I could hear the nervous breathing of the caretaker and noticed the sour smell of her sweat. I felt like a tomb robber whose soul is poisoned by greed and desire.
Hey, what's that noise?
Asked the caretaker in an anxious tone. Something fluttered in the dark, disturbed by our presence. I thought I glimpsed a pale shape flickering about at the end of the corridor.
Pigeons, I said. They must have got in through a broken window and made a nest here.
Those ugly birds give me the creeps, said the caretaker, and they shit like there's no tomorrow.
Relax, Doña Aurora. They only attack when they're hungry.
We ventured in a few steps till we reached the end of the corridor, where a dining room opened onto the balcony. Just visible was a shabby table covered with a tattered tablecloth that looked more like a shroud. Four chairs held a wake, together with a couple of grimy glass cabinets that guarded the crockery, an assortment of glasses, and a tea set. In a corner stood the old upright piano that had belonged to Carrick's mother. The keys were dark with dirt, and the joins could hardly be seen under the film of dust. An armchair with a long threadbare cover was slowly disintegrating next to the balcony. Beside it was a coffee table, on which rested a pair of reading glasses and a Bible bound in pale leather and edged with gold, of the sort that used to be given as presents for a child's first communion. It still had its bookmark, a piece of scarlet string.
Look, that chair is where the old man was found dead. The doctor said he'd been there for 2 days. How sad to go like that, like a dog, all alone. Not that he didn't have it coming, but even so.
I went up to the chair where Fortuny had died. Next to the Bible was a small box containing black and white photographs. Old studio portraits. I knelt down to examine them, almost afraid to touch them. I felt as if I was profaning the memories of a poor old man, but my curiosity got the better of me. The first print showed a young couple with a boy who could not have been more than 4 years old. I recognised him by his eyes.
Look, there they are. Signor Fortuny as a young man, and her.
Didn't Julian have any brothers or sisters? The caretaker shrugged her shoulders and let out a sigh.
I heard rumours that she miscarried once because of the beatings her husband gave her, but I don't know. People love to gossip, don't they? But not me. All I know is that once Julian told the other kids in the building that he had a sister only he could see. He said she came out of mirrors as if she were made of thin air, and that she lived with Satan himself, in a palace at the bottom of a lake. My Isabelita had nightmares for a whole month. That child could be really morbid at times.
I glanced at the kitchen. There was a broken pane in a small window overlooking an inner courtyard, and you could hear the nervous and hostile flapping of the pigeons' wings on the other side. Do all the apartments have the same layout? I asked.
The ones that look onto the street do, but this one is an attic, so it's a bit different. There's the kitchen and a laundry room that overlooks the inner yard. Down this corridor, there are 3 bedrooms and a bathroom at the end. Properly decorated, they can look very nice, believe me. This one is similar to my Isabelita's apartment, but of course right now it looks like a tomb.
Do you know which room Julian's was?
The first door is the master bedroom. The second is a smaller room. It was probably that one, I'd say.
I went down the corridor. The paint on the walls was falling off in shreds. At the end of the passage, the bathroom door was ajar. A face seemed to stare at me from the mirror. It could have been mine, or perhaps the face of the sister who lived there. As I got closer, it withdrew into darkness. I tried to open the second door. It's locked, I said. The caretaker looked at me in astonishment.
These doors don't have locks, she said.
This one does.
Then the old man must have had it put in because all the other apartments.
I looked down and noticed that the footprints in the dust led up to the locked door. Someone's been in this room, I said, recently.
Don't scare me, said the caretaker.
I went up to the other door. It didn't have a lock. It opened with a rusty groan when I touched it. In the middle stood an old 4-poster bed, unmade. The sheets had turned yellowish, like winding sheets, and a crucifix presided over the bed. The room also contained a chest of drawers with a small mirror on it, a basin, a pitcher, and a chair. A cupboard, its door ajar, stood against the wall. I went around the bed to a bedside table with a glass top, under which lay photographs of ancestors, funeral cards, and lottery tickets. On the table were a carved wooden music box and a pocket watch, frozen forever at 5:20. I tried to wind up the music box, but the melody got stuck after 6 notes. When I opened the drawer of the bedside table, I found an empty spectacle case, a nail clipper, a hip flask, and a medal of the Virgin of Lourdes. Nothing else.
There must be a key to that room somewhere, I said.
The manager must have it. Look, I think it's best we leave.
Suddenly, I looked down at the music box. I lifted the cover, and there, blocking the mechanism, I found a gold key. I took it out, and the music box resumed its tinkling melody. I recognised a tune by Ravel. This must be the key, I smiled at the caretaker.
Listen, if the room was locked, there must be a reason, even if it's just out of respect for the memory of...
If you'd rather, you can wait for me down in your apartment, Doña Aurora.
You're a devil,
Go on. Open up if you must.
Chapter 16. A breath of cold air whistled through the hole in the lock, licking at my fingers while I inserted the key. The lock that Signor Fortuny had fitted in the door of his son's unoccupied room was 3 times the size of the one on the front door. Doña Aurora looked at me apprehensively, as if we were about to open a Pandora's box. "Is this room at the front of the house?" I asked. The caretaker shook her head.
"It has a small window for ventilation. It looks out over the yard."
I pushed the door inward. An impenetrable well of darkness opened up before us, the meagre light from behind barely scratching at the shadows. The window overlooking the yard was covered with pages of yellowed newspaper. I tore them off, and a needle of hazy light bored through the darkness.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph," murmured the caretaker.
The room was infested with crucifixes. They hung from the ceiling, dangling from the ends of strings, and they covered the walls, hooked on nails. There were dozens of them. You could sense them in every corner, carved with a knife on the wooden furniture, scratched on the floor tiles, painted red on the mirrors. The footprints that had led us to the doorway could now be traced on the dust around the naked bed, just a skeleton of wires and worm-eaten wood. At one end of the room, under the window, stood a closed roll-top desk, crowned by a trio of metal crucifixes. I opened it with care. There was no dust in the joins of the wooden slats, from which I inferred that the desk had been opened quite recently. It had 6 drawers. The locks had been forced open. I inspected them one by one. Empty. I knelt down by the desk and fingered the scratches that covered the wood, imagining Julian Carax's hands making those doodles, hieroglyphics, whose meaning had been obscured by time. In the desk, I noticed a pile of notebooks and a vase filled with pencils and pens. I took one of the notebooks and glanced at it. Drawings and single words. Mathematical exercises. Unconnected phrases. Quotes from books. Unfinished poems. All the notebooks looked the same. Some drawings were repeated page after page with slight variations. I was struck by the figure of a man who seemed to be made of flames. Another might have been an angel or a reptile coiled around a cross. Rough sketches hinted at a fantastic rambling house woven with towers and cathedral-like arches. The strokes were confident and showed a certain ability. Young Carax appeared to be a draftsman of some promise, but none of the drawings were more than rough sketches. I was about to put the last notebook back in its place without looking at it, when something slipped out of its pages and fell at my feet. It was a photograph, in which I recognised the same girl who appeared in the other picture, the one taken at the foot of that building. The girl posed in a luxurious garden, and beyond the treetops, just visible, was the shape of the house I had seen sketched in the drawings of the adolescent Carax. I recognised it immediately. It was the villa called the White Friar on Avenida del Tibidabo. On the back of the photograph was an inscription that simply said, "Penelope, who loves you?" I put it in my pocket, closed the desk, and smiled at the caretaker.
"Seen enough?"
she asked, anxious to leave the place. "Almost," I replied.
"Before, you said that soon after Julian left for Paris, a letter came for him, but his father told you to throw it away."
The caretaker hesitated for a moment, and then she nodded.
"I put the letter in the drawer of the cabinet in the entrance hall, in case the Frenchwoman should come back one day. It must still be there."
We went down to the cabinet and opened the top drawer. An ochre-coloured envelope lay on top of a collection of stopped watches, buttons and coins that had ceased being legal tender 20 years ago. I picked up the envelope and examined it.
"Did you read it?"
"What do you take me for?"
I meant no offence. It would have been quite natural under the circumstances if you thought that Julian was dead. The caretaker shrugged, looked down, and started walking towards the door. I took advantage of that moment to put the letter in the inside pocket of my jacket.
Look, I don't want you to get the wrong impression, said the caretaker.
Of course not. What did the letter say?
It was a love letter, like the stories on the radio, only sadder, you know, because it sounded as if it were really true. Oh, believe me, I felt like crying when I read it.
You're all heart, Doña Aurora.
And you're a devil.
That same afternoon, after saying goodbye to Doña Aurora and promising that I would keep her up to date with my investigations on Julian Carax, I went along to see the manager of the apartment block. Señor Mullins had seen better days and now moulded away in a filthy first-floor office on Calle Florida Blanca. Still, Mullins was a cheerful and self-satisfied individual. His mouth was glued to a half-smoked cigar that seemed to grow out of his moustache. It was hard to tell whether he was asleep or awake because he breathed like most people snore. His hair was greasy and flattened over his forehead, and he had mischievous piggy eyes. His suit wouldn't have fetched more than 10 pesetas in the Encantes flea market, but he made up for it with a gaudy tie of tropical colours. Judging by the appearance of the office, not much was managed anymore, except the bugs and cobwebs of a forgotten Barcelona.
"Well, in the middle of refurbishment,"
he said apologetically. To break the ice, I let drop Doña Aurora's name as if I were referring to some old friend of the family.
"When she was young, she was a real looker,"
was Mullins' comment.
"With age, she's gone on the heavier side, but then I'm not what I used to be either. You may not believe this, but when I was your age, I was an Adonis. Girls would go on their knees to beg for a quickie or to have my babies. Alas, the 20th century is nothing but shit. What could I do for you, young man?"
I presented him with a more or less plausible story about a supposed distant relationship with the Fortunis. After 5 minutes' chatter, Mullins dragged himself to his filing cabinet and gave me the address of the lawyer who dealt with anything related to Sophie Carax, Julian's mother.
"Let me see. José María Requejo, 59 Calle León, the 13th, but we send the mail twice a year to a P.O. box in the main post office on Via Laetana."
"Do you know Signor Requejo?"
"I've spoken to his secretary occasionally on the telephone. The fact is that any business with him is done by post, and my secretary deals with that, and today she's at the hairdresser's. Lawyers don't have time for face-to-face dealings anymore. There are no gentlemen left in the profession."
There didn't seem to be any reliable addresses left either. A quick glance at the street guide on the manager's desk confirmed what I suspected. The address of the supposed lawyer, Signor Requejo, didn't exist. I told Mr. Mullins, who took the news in as if it were a joke.
"Well, I'll be damned," he said, laughing. "What did I say? Crooks?"
The manager lay back in his chair and made another of his snoring noises. "Would you happen to have the number of that P.O. box?"
"According to the index card, it's 2837, although I can't read my secretary's numbers. As I'm sure you know, women are no good at maths. What they're good for is..."
"May I see the card?"
"Sure, help yourself."
He handed me the index card and I looked at it. The numbers were perfectly legible. The P.O. box was 2321. It horrified me to think of the accounting that must have gone on in that office. "Did you have much contact with Signor Fortuny during his lifetime?" I asked.
So. Quite an ascetic type. I remember that when I found out that a French woman had left him, I invited him to go whoring with a few mates of mine nearby in a fabulous establishment I know next to the La Paloma dance hall. Just to cheer him up, eh? That's all. And you know what? He would not talk to me, even greet me in the street anymore, as if I were invisible. What do you make of that?"
"I'm in shock. What else can you tell me about the Fortuny family? Do you remember them well?"
"Those were different times," he murmured nostalgically.
The fact is that I already knew Grandfather Fortuny, the one who started the hat shop. About the son, there isn't much to tell. Now the wife, oh, she was spectacular. What a woman. And decent, too, despite all the rumours and the gossip.
Like the one about Julian's not being Fortuny's legitimate son.
And where did you hear that?
As I said, I'm part of the family. Everything gets out.
None of that was ever proved.
But it was talked about, I said encouragingly.
People talk too much. Humans aren't descended from monkeys. They come from parrots.
And what did people say?
Don't you feel like a little glass of rum? It's Cuban, like all the good stuff that kills you.
No thanks, but I'll keep you company. In the meantime, you can tell me.
Antoni Fortuny, whom everyone called the Hatter, met Sophie Carracks in 1899 by the steps of Barcelona Cathedral. He was returning from making a vow to St. Eustace, for of all the saints, St. Eustace was considered the most diligent and the least fussy when it came to granting miracles to do with love. Antoni Fortuny, who was already over 30 and a confirmed bachelor, was looking for a wife and wanted her right away. Sophie was a French girl who lived in a boarding house for young ladies in Caerier Alta and gave private music and piano lessons to the offspring of the most privileged families in Barcelona. She had no family or capital to rely on, only her youth and what musical education she had received from her father, the pianist at a Nîmes theatre, before he died of tuberculosis in 1886. Antoni Fortuny, on the contrary, was a man on the road to prosperity. He had recently inherited his father's business, a hat shop of some repute in Ronda de San Antonio, where he had learned the trade that he dreamed one day of teaching his own son. He found Sophie Carracks fragile, beautiful, young, docile, and fertile. St. Eustace had obliged. After 4 months of insistent courting, Sophie accepted Antoni's marriage proposal. Signor Molins, who had been a friend of Fortuny the elder, warned Antoni that he was marrying a stranger. He said that Sophie seemed like a nice girl, but perhaps this marriage was a bit too convenient for her, and he should wait a year at least. Antoni Fortuny replied that he already knew everything he needed to know about his future wife. The rest did not interest him. They were married at the Basilica del Pino and spent their 3-day honeymoon in a spa in the nearby seaside resort of Montgat. The morning before they left, the Hatter asked Signor Molins, in confidence, to be initiated into the mysteries of the bedroom. Molins sarcastically told him to ask his wife. The newlyweds returned to Barcelona after only 2 days. The neighbours said Sophie was crying when she came into the building. Years later, Vicenceta swore that Sophie had told her the following, that the Hatter had not laid a finger on her, and that when she had tried to seduce him, he had called her a whore and told her he was disgusted by the obscenity of what she was proposing. 6 months later, Sophie announced to her husband that she was with child by another man. Antoni Fortuny had seen his own father hit his mother on countless occasions and did what he thought was the right thing to do. He stopped only when he feared that one more blow would kill her. Despite the beating, Sophie refused to reveal the identity of the child's father. Applying his own logic to the matter, Antoni Fortuny decided that it must be the devil, for that child was the child of sin, and sin had only one father, the evil one. Convinced in this manner that sin had sneaked into his home and also between his wife's thighs, the Hatter took to hanging crucifixes everywhere, on the walls, on the doors of all the rooms, and on the ceiling. When Sophie discovered him scattering crosses in the bedroom to which she had been confined, she grew afraid and, with tears in her eyes, asked him whether he had gone mad. Blind with rage, he turned around and hit her. "A whore like the rest," he spat as he threw her out onto the landing, after flaying her with blows from his belt.
The following day, when Antoni Fortuny opened the door of his apartment to go down to the hat shop, Sophie was still there, covered in dried blood and shivering with cold. The doctors never managed to fix the fractures on her right hand completely. Sophie Carax would never be able to play the piano again. But she would give birth to a boy, whom she would name Julian, after the father she had lost when she was still too young. As happens with all good things in life. Fortuny considered throwing her out of his home, but thought the scandal would not be good for business. Nobody would buy hats from a man known to be a cuckold. The two didn't go together. From then on, Sophie was assigned a dark, cold room at the back of the apartment. It was there she gave birth to her son, with the help of two neighbours. Antoni did not return home until 3 days later.
"This is the son God has given you," Sophie announced. "If you want to punish anyone, punish me, but not an innocent creature. The boy needs a home and a father. My sins are not his. I beg you to take pity on us."
The first months were difficult for both of them. Antoni Fortuny had downgraded his wife to the rank of servant. They no longer shared a bed or table and rarely exchanged any words except to resolve some domestic matter. Once a month, usually coinciding with the full moon, Antoni Fortuny showed up in Sophie's bedroom at dawn and, without a word, charged at his former wife with vigour but little skill. Making the most of these rare and aggressive moments of intimacy, Sophie tried to win him over by whispering words of love and caressing him. But the hatter was not a man for frivolities, and the eagerness of desire evaporated in a matter of minutes or even seconds. These assaults brought no children. After a few years, Antoni Fortuny stopped visiting Sophie's chamber for good and took up the habit of reading the Gospels until the small hours, seeking in them a solace for his torment. With the help of the Gospels, the hatter made an effort to kindle some affection for the child with deep eyes, who loved making a joke of everything and inventing shadows where there were none. Despite his efforts, Antoni Fortuny was unable to feel as if little Julian were his flesh and blood, nor did he recognize any aspect of himself in him. The boy, for his part, did not seem very interested either in hats or in the teachings of the catechism. During the Christmas season, he would amuse himself by changing the positions of the small figures in the nativity scene and devising plots in which baby Jesus had been kidnapped by the three magi from the east, who had wicked intentions. He soon became obsessed with drawing angels with wolf's teeth and inventing stories about hooded spirits that came out of walls and ate people's ideas while they slept. In time, the hatter lost all hope of being able to set this boy on the right path. The child was not a Fortuny, and never would be. Julian maintained that he was bored in school and came home with his notebooks full of drawings of monstrous beings, winged serpents, and buildings that were alive, walked, and devoured the unsuspecting. By then it was quite clear that fantasy and invention interested him far more than the daily reality around him. Of all the disappointments amassed during his lifetime, none hurt Antoni Fortuny more than that son whom the devil had sent to mock him. At the age of 10, Julian announced that he wanted to be a painter, like Velázquez. He dreamed of embarking on canvases that the great master had been unable to paint during his life because, Julian argued, he'd been obliged to paint so many time-consuming portraits of mentally retarded royals. To make matters worse, Sophie, perhaps to relieve her loneliness and remember her father, decided to give him piano lessons. Julian, who loved music, art, and all matters that were not considered practical in the world of men, soon learned the rudiments of harmony and concluded that he preferred to invent his own compositions rather than follow the music book scores. At that time, Antoni Fortuny still suspected that part of the boy's mental deficiencies were due to his diet, which was far too influenced by his mother's French cooking. It was a well-known fact that the richness of buttery foods led to moral ruin and confusion of the intellect. He forbade Sophie to cook with butter ever again. The results were not entirely as he had anticipated. At 12, Julian began to lose his feverish interest in painting and in Velázquez,
But the Hatter's initial hopes did not last long. Julian was abandoning his canvas dreams for a far more pernicious vice. He had discovered the library in Calle del Carmen and devoted any time he was allowed off from the hat shop to visiting the sanctuary of books and devouring volumes of fiction, poetry and history. The day before his 13th birthday, he announced that he wanted to be someone called Robert Louis Stevenson, evidently a foreigner. The Hatter remarked that, with luck, he'd become a quarry worker. At that point, he became convinced that his son was nothing but an idiot. At night, Antoni Fortuny often writhed in his bed with anger and frustration, unable to get any sleep. At the bottom of his heart, he loved that child, he told himself. And although she didn't deserve it, he also loved the slut who had betrayed him from the very first day. He loved her with all his soul, but in his own way, which was the correct way. All he asked God was to show him how the three of them could be happy, preferably also in his own way. He begged the Lord to send him a signal, a whisper, a crumb of his presence. God, in his infinite wisdom and perhaps overwhelmed by the avalanche of requests from so many tormented souls, did not answer. While Antoni Fortuny was engulfed by remorse and suspicion, on the other side of the wall, Sophie slowly faded away, her life shipwrecked on a sea of disappointment, isolation and guilt. She did not love the man she served, but she felt she belonged to him, and the possibility of leaving him and taking his son with her to some other place seemed inconceivable. She remembered Julian's real father with bitterness, and eventually grew to hate him and everything he stood for. In her desperation, she began to shout back at Antoni Fortuny. Insults and sharp recriminations flew round the apartment like knives, stabbing anyone who dared get in their way, usually Julian. Later, the Hatter never remembered exactly why he had beaten his wife. He remembered only the anger and the shame. He would then swear to himself that this would never happen again, that, if necessary, he would give himself up to the authorities and get himself locked up in prison. Antoni Fortuny was sure that, with God's help, he would end up being a better man than his own father. But sooner or later, his fists would once more meet Sophie's tender flesh, and in time Fortuny felt that if he could not possess her as a husband, he would do so as a tyrant. In this manner, secretly, the Fortuny family let the years go by, silencing their hearts and their souls to the point where, from so much keeping quiet, they forgot the words with which to express their real feelings, and the family became strangers living under the same roof, like so many other families in the vast city. It was past 2:30 when I returned to the bookshop. As I walked in, Fermin gave me a sarcastic look from the top of a ladder, where he was polishing up a collection of the Episodios Nacionales by the famous Don Benito.
"Who is this I see before me? We thought he must have set off to the new world by now, Daniel."
"I got delayed on the way. Where's my father?"
"Since you didn't turn up, he went off to deliver the rest of the orders. He asked me to tell you that this afternoon he is going to Tiana to value a private library belonging to a widow. Your father's a wolf in sheep's clothing. He said not to wait for him to close the shop."
"Was he annoyed?" Fermin shook his head, coming down the stepladder with feline nimbleness.
"Not at all. Your father is a saint. Besides, he was very happy to see you dating a young lady."
"What?" Fermin winked at me and smacked his lips.
"Oh, you little devil, you were hiding your light under a bushel. And what a girl, eh? Good enough to stop traffic, and such class. You can tell she's been to good schools, although she has fire in her eyes. If Bernarda hadn't stole my heart, and I haven't told you all about our outing yet, there were sparks coming out of those eyes, I tell you, sparks. It was like a bonfire on Midsummer's night."
"Fermin," I interrupted, "what the hell are you talking about?"
"About your fiancé."
"I don't have a fiancé, Fermin."
"Well, these days you young people call them anything, sugar pie or..."
"Fermin, will you please rewind? What are you talking about?" Fermin Romero de Torres looked at me disconcertedly.
"Let me see. This afternoon, about an hour, or an hour and a half ago, a gorgeous young lady came by and asked for you. Your father and yours truly were on the premises, and I can assure you, without a shadow of doubt, that the girl was no apparition. I could even describe her smell. Lavender, only sweeter. Like a little sugar bun just out of the oven.
Did little sugar bun say she was my fiancée, by any chance?
Well, not in so many words, but she gave a sort of quick smile, if you see what I mean, and said that she would see you on Friday afternoon. All we did was put two and two together.
Bea, I mumbled.
Ergo, she exists, said Fermin with relief. Yes, but she's not my girlfriend. Well, I don't know what you're waiting for, then. She's Tomás Aguilar's sister. Your friend the inventor?
I nodded.
All the more reason. Even if she were the Pope's niece, she's a bombshell. If I were you, I'd be on the ready.
Bea already has a fiancé, a lieutenant doing his military service.
Fermin sighed with irritation. Ugh, the army! Blight and refuge for the basest simian instincts. All the better because this way you can cheat on him without feeling guilty.
You're delirious, Fermin. Bea's getting married when the lieutenant finishes his service.
Fermin gave me a sneaky smile. Funny you should say that, because I have a feeling she's not. I don't think this pumpkin is going to be tying the knot any time soon.
What do you know?
About women and other worldly matters, considerably more than you. As Freud tells us, women want the opposite of what they think or say they want, which, when you consider it, is not so bad because men, as is more than evident, respond contrary-wise to the dictates of their genital and digestive organs. Stop lecturing me, Fermin. I can see where this is heading. If you have anything to say, just say it. Right, then, in a nutshell, this one hasn't a single bone of obedient little wife material in her heavenly body.
Hasn't she? And what kind of bone does your expertise detect?
Fermin came closer, adopting a confidential tone.
The passionate kind, he said,
raising his eyebrows with an air of mystery.
And you can be sure, I mean that, as a compliment.
As usual, Fermin was right. Feeling defeated, I decided that attack was the best form of defence.
Speaking of passion, tell me about Bernarda. Was there or was there not a kiss?
Oh, don't insult me, Daniel. Let me remind you that you are talking to a professional in the art of seduction.
And this business of kissing is for amateurs.
And little old men in slippers.
Real women are won over bit by bit. It's all a question of psychology, like a good faena in the bullring.
In other words, she gave you the brush off.
The woman is yet to be born who is capable of giving Fermin Romero de Torres the brush off.
The trouble is that man, going back to Freud, and excuse the metaphor, heats up like a light bulb, red hot in the twinkling of an eye and cold again in a flash.
The female, on the other hand, and this is pure science, heats up like an iron, slowly, over a low heat, like a tasty stew. But then,
when she has heated up, there's no stopping her. Like the steel furnaces in Vizcaya.
I weighed up Fermin's thermodynamic theories.
Is that what you're doing with Bernarda? Heating up the iron?
Fermin winked at me.
That woman is a volcano on the point of eruption, with a libido of igneous magma, yet the heart of an angel, he said, licking his lips.
If I had to establish a true parallel, she reminds me of my succulent mulatto girl in Havana, who was very devout and always worshipped her saints. But since deep down I'm an old-fashioned gent who doesn't like to take advantage of women, I contented myself with a chaste kiss on the cheek.
I'm not in a hurry, you see. All good things must wait. There are yokels out there who think that if they touch a woman's behind and she doesn't complain, they've hooked her. Amateurs! The female heart is a labyrinth of subtleties, too challenging for the uncouth mind of the male racketeer. If you really want to possess a woman, you must think like her. And first thing to do is to win over her soul. The rest, that sweet, soft rapping which steals away your senses and your virtue, is a bonus. I clapped solemnly at this discourse.
You're a poet, Fermin.
No, I'm with Ortega and I'm a pragmatist. Poetry lies in its adorable wicked way, and what I say is truer than a slice of bread and tomato.
That's just what the master said. Show me a Don Juan and I'll show you a loser in disguise. What I aim for is permanence, durability.
Bear witness that I will make Bernarda, if not an honest woman, because that she already is, at least a happy one. I smiled as I nodded. His enthusiasm was contagious, and his diction beyond improvement. Take good care of her, Fermin. Do it for me. Bernarda has a heart of gold, and she has already suffered too many disappointments.
Do you think I can't see that? It's written all over her, like a stamp from the Society of War Widows.
Trust me, I wrote the book on taking shit from everybody and his mother. I'm going to make this woman blissfully happy, even if it's the last thing I ever do in this world. Do I have your word? He stretched out his hand with the composure of a Knight Templar. I shook it. Yes, the word of Fermin Romero de Torres. Business in the shop was slow that afternoon, with barely a couple of browsers. In view of the situation, I suggested Fermin take the rest of the day off. Go on, go and find Bernarda and take her to the cinema, or go window shopping with her in Calle Puerta Farisa. Walking arm in arm, she loves that. Fermin did not hesitate to take me up on my offer, and rushed off to smarten himself up in the back room, where he always kept a change of clothes and all kinds of eau de colognes and ointments in a toilet bag that would have been the envy of Veronica Lake. When he emerged, he looked like a film star, only 5 stone lighter. He wore a suit that had belonged to my father and a felt hat that was a couple of sizes too large, a problem he solved by placing balls of newspaper under the crown. By the way, Fermin, before you go, I wanted to ask you a favour. Say no more. You give the order, I'm already onto it. I'm going to ask you to keep this between us, okay? Not a word to my father. He beamed. Ah, you rascal. Something to do with that girl, eh? No, this is a matter of high intrigue. Your department. Well, I also know a lot about girls. I'm telling you this because if you ever have a technical query, you know who to ask. Privacy assured. I'm like a doctor when it comes to such matters. No need to be prudish. I'll bear that in mind. Right now, what I would like to know is who owns a P.O. box in the main post office on Via Laietana, number 2321, and if possible, who collects the mail that goes there. Do you think you'll be able to lend me a hand? Fermin wrote down the number with a ballpoint on his instep under his sock. Piece of cake. All official institutions find me irresistible. Give me a few days and I'll have a full report ready for you. We agreed not to say a word of this to my father. Don't worry. I'll be as quiet as the Sphinx. I'm very grateful, now. Go on, off with you and have a good time. I said goodbye with a military salute and watched him leave, looking as debonair as a cock on his way to the henhouse. He couldn't have been gone for more than 5 minutes when I heard the tinkle of the doorbell and lifted my head from the columns of numbers and crossings out. A man had just come in, hidden behind a grey raincoat and a felt hat. He sported a pencil moustache and had glassy blue eyes. He smiled like a salesman, a forced smile. I was sorry Fermin was not there because he was an expert at seeing off travellers selling camphor and other such rubbish whenever they slipped into the bookshop. The visitor offered me his greasy grin, casually picking up a book from a pile that stood by the entrance, waiting to be sorted and priced. Everything about him communicated disdain for all he saw. You're not even going to sell me a good afternoon, I thought. A lot of words, eh? He said. It's a book. They usually have quite a few words. Anything I can do for you, sir? The man put the book back on the pile, nodding indifferently and ignoring my question. I say reading is for people who have a lot of time and nothing to do. Like women. Those of us who have to work don't have time for make-believe. We're too busy earning a living. Don't you agree? It's an opinion. Were you looking for anything in particular? It's not an opinion. It's a fact. That's what's wrong with this country. People don't want to work. There are a lot of layabouts around, don't you agree? I don't know, sir, perhaps. Here, as you can see, we only sell books. The man came up to the counter, his eyes darting around the shop, settling occasionally on mine. His appearance and manner seemed vaguely familiar, though I couldn't say why. Something about him reminded me of one of those figures from old-fashioned playing cards or the sort used by fortune-tellers. A print straight from the pages of an incunabulum. His presence was both funereal and incandescent, like a curse dressed in its Sunday best. If you'll tell me what I can do for you. It's really me who's coming to do you a service. Are you the owner of this establishment? No, the owner is my father. And the name is? My name or my father's? The man proffered a sarcastic smile. A giggler, I thought. I take it that the sign saying Semperi and Son applies to both of you, then. That's very perceptive of you. May I ask the reason for your visit, if you're not interested in a book? The reason for my visit, a courtesy call if you like, is to warn you. It has come to my attention that you're doing business with undesirable characters, in particular, inverts and criminals. I stared at him in astonishment. Excuse me? The man fixed me with his eyes. I'm talking about queers and thieves. Don't tell me you don't know what I'm talking about. I'm afraid I haven't the faintest idea, nor am I remotely interested in listening to you any longer. The man nodded in an unfriendly and truculent manner. You'll just have to endure me then. I suppose you're aware of citizen Federico Flabia's activities. Don Federico is the local watchmaker, an excellent person. I very much doubt that he's a criminal. I was talking about queers. I have proof that this old queen frequents your shop. I imagine to buy little romantic novels and pornography. And may I ask you what business this is of yours? His answer was to pull out his wallet and place it open on the counter. I recognised a grimy police ID with his picture on it, looking a bit younger. I read up to where it said, Chief Inspector Francisco Javier Fumero. Speak to me with respect, boy, or you and your father will be in deep trouble for selling communist rubbish, do you hear? I wanted to reply, but the words had frozen on my lips. Still, this queer isn't what brought me here today. Sooner or later, he'll end up in the police station like all the rest of his persuasion, and I'll make sure he's given a lesson. Now, what worries me is that, according to my information, you're employing a common thief, an undesirable of the worst sort. I don't know what you're talking about, Inspector. Fumero gave his servile, sticky giggle. God only knows what name he's using now. Years ago he called himself Wilfredo Camugay, the Mambo King, and said he was an expert in voodoo, dance teacher to the Bourbon royal heir and Matahari's lover. Oh, other times he takes the names of ambassadors, variety artists or bullfighters. We've lost count by now. I'm afraid I'm unable to help you. I don't know anyone called Wilfredo Camugay. I'm sure you don't. But you know who I'm referring to, don't you? No? Fumero laughed again, that forced, affected laugh, that seemed to sum him up like the blurb on a book jacket. You like to make things difficult, don't you? Look, I've come here as a friend, to warn you that whoever takes on someone as undesirable as this one ends up with his fingers scorched. Yet, you're treating me like a liar. Not at all. I appreciate your visit and your warning, but I can assure you that there hasn't... Don't give me that crap! Because if I damn well feel like it, I'll beat the shit out of you and lock you up in the slammer. Is that clear? But today I'm in a good mood, so I'm going to leave you with just a warning. It's up to you to choose your company. If you like queers and thieves, you must be a bit of both yourself. Things have to be clear where I'm concerned. Either you're with me, or you're against me. That's life. That's simple. So, what's it going to be? I didn't say anything. Fumero nodded, letting go another giggle. Very good, Signor Semperi. It's your call. Not a very good beginning for us. If you want problems, you'll get them. Life isn't like a novel, you know. In life, you have to take sides.
and it's clear which side you've chosen.
The side taken by idiots.
The losing side.
I'm going to ask you to leave, please.
He walked off toward the door, followed by his sibylline laugh.
We'll meet again! And tell your friend that Inspector Fumero is keeping an eye on him and sends him his best regards.
The call from the inspector and the echo of his words ruined my afternoon. After a quarter of an hour of running to and fro behind the counter, my stomach tightening into a knot, I decided to close the bookshop before the usual time and go out for a walk. I wandered about aimlessly, unable to rid my mind of the insinuations and threats made by that sinister thug. I wondered whether I should alert my father and Fermin about the visit, but I imagined that would have been precisely Fumero's intention, to sow doubt, anguish, fear, and uncertainty among us. I decided not to play his game. On the other hand, his suggestions about Fermin's past alarmed me. I felt ashamed of myself on discovering that for a moment I had given credit to the policeman's words. In the end, after much consideration, I decided to banish the entire episode to the back of my mind. On my way home, I passed the watchmaker's shop. Don Federico greeted me from behind the counter, beckoning me to come in. The watchmaker was an affable, cheerful character who never forgot anyone's birthday. The sort of person you could always go to with a dilemma, knowing that he would find a solution. I couldn't help shivering at the thought that he was on Inspector Fumero's blacklist and wondered whether I should warn him. Although I could not imagine how, without getting caught up in matters that were none of my business. Feeling more confused than ever, I went into his shop and smiled at him.
How are you, Daniel? What's that face for?
Bad day, I said.
How's everything, Don Federico? Smooth as silk. They don't make watches like they used to anymore, so I've got plenty of work. If things go on like this, I'm going to have to hire an assistant. Your friend, the inventor, would he be interested? He must be good at this sort of thing.
It didn't take much to imagine what Tomas's reactionary father would think of his son accepting a job in the establishment of the neighbourhood's official fairy queen. I'll let him know.
By the way, Daniel, I've got the alarm clock your father brought round 2 weeks ago. I don't know what he did to it, but he'd be better off buying a new one than having it fixed.
I remembered that sometimes, on suffocating summer nights, my father would sleep out on the balcony. It probably fell onto the street, I said.
That explains it. Ask him to let me know what to do about it. I can get a radiant for him at a very good price. Look, take this one with you if you like, and let him try it out. If he likes it, he can pay for it later. If not, just bring it back.
Thank you very much, Don Federico. The watchmaker began to wrap up the monstrosity in question.
The latest technology, he said with pleasure. Oh, by the way, I loved the book Fermin sold me the other day. It was by this fellow, Graham Greene. Oh, that Fermin was a tremendous hire.
I nodded. Yes, he's worth twice his weight in gold.
I've noticed he never wears a watch. Tell him to come by the shop and we'll sort something out.
I will. Thank you, Don Federico. When he handed me the alarm clock, the watchmaker observed me closely and arched his eyebrows.
Are you sure there's nothing the matter, Daniel? Just a bad day?
I nodded again and smiled. There's nothing the matter, Don Federico.
Take care. You too, Daniel.
When I got home, I found my father asleep on the sofa, the newspaper on his chest. I left the alarm clock on the table with a note saying, Don Federico says dump the old one, and slipped quietly into my room. I lay down on my bed in the dark and fell asleep thinking about the inspector, Fermin, and the watchmaker. When I woke up again, it was already 2 o'clock in the morning. I peered into the corridor and saw that my father had retired to his bedroom with the new alarm clock. The apartment was full of shadows, and the world seemed a gloomier and more sinister place than it had been only the night before. I realized that, in fact, I never quite believed that Inspector Fumero existed. I went into the kitchen
poured myself a glass of cold milk, and wondered whether Fermin would be all right in his pension. On my way back to the room, I tried to banish the image of the policeman from my mind. I tried to get back to sleep, but realized that it was impossible. I turned on the light and decided to examine the envelope addressed to Julian Carax that I had stolen from Doña Aurora that morning and which was still in the pocket of my jacket. I placed it on my desk under the beam of the reading lamp. It was a parchment-like envelope with yellowing serrated borders and clayish to the touch. The postmark, just a shadow, said 18th of October, 1919. The wax seal had come unstuck, probably thanks to Doña Aurora's good offices. In its place was a reddish stain, like a trace of lipstick that kissed the fold of the envelope on which the return address was written. Penelope Aldaya, Avenida del Tibidabo, 32, Barcelona. I opened the envelope and pulled out the letter, an ochre-coloured sheet neatly folded in two. The handwriting in blue ink glided nervously across the page, paling slowly until it regained intensity every few words. Everything on that page spoke of another time. The strokes that depended on the inkpot, the words scratched on the thick paper by the tip of the nib, the rugged feel of the paper. I spread the letter out on the desk and read it, breathless. Dear Julian, this morning I found out through Jorge that you did in fact leave Barcelona to go in pursuit of your dreams. I always feared that those dreams would never allow you to be mine, or anyone else's. I would have liked to see you one last time, to be able to look into your eyes and tell you things that I don't know how to say in a letter. Nothing came out the way we had planned. I know you too well, and I know you won't write to me, that you won't even send me your address, that you will want to be another person. I know you will hate me for not having been there, as I had promised. That you will think I failed you, that I didn't have the courage. I have imagined you so many times alone on that train, convinced that I had betrayed you. Many times I tried to find you through Miquel, but he told me that you didn't want to have anything more to do with me. What lies did they tell you, Julian? What did they say about me? Why did you believe them? Now I know I have already lost you. I have lost everything. Even so, I can't let you go forever and allow you to forget me without letting you know that I don't bear you any grudge, that I knew it from the start. I knew that I was going to lose you, and that you would never see in me what I see in you. I want you to know that I loved you from the very first day, and that I still love you, now more than ever, even if you don't want me to. I am writing to you in secret, without anyone knowing. Jorge has sworn that if he sees you again, he'll kill you. I'm not allowed to go out of the house anymore. I can't even look out of the window. I don't think they'll ever forgive me. Someone I trust has promised to post this letter to you. I won't mention the name, so as not to compromise the person in question. I don't know whether my words will reach you, but if they do, and should you decide to return to fetch me here, I know you will find the way to do it. As I write, I imagine you in that train, full of dreams and with your soul broken by betrayal, fleeing from us all and from yourself. There are so many things I cannot tell you, Julian. Things we never knew. And it's better you should never know. All I wish is for you to be happy, Julian. That everything you aspire to achieve may come true, and that although you may forget me in the course of time, one day you may finally understand how much I loved you. Always, Penelope.